Welcome to the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast. I'm Eva Monheim.
And I'm Hal Rosner. We are both certified arborists through the International Society of Arboriculture. The purpose of our podcast is to encourage tree planting and proper tree care for our urban forests, which include neighborhoods, parks, and other open spaces.
We will also cover a myriad of tree topics, including the important role trees play in relationship to the climate crisis. Thank you for joining us. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Monheim Microphones. Monheim Microphones designs and handcrafts top-tier studio microphones and preamps right here in the United States in Hollywood, California. Their incredible line of innovative microphones and designs are used around the world by everyone from podcasters to top-charting record producers and singers. They recently released their new royalty microphone, Monheim Microphones Unparalleled Excellence, monheimmicrophones.com.
Verdant Earth Educators provides dynamic in-person training and online learning opportunities for environmental and horticultural businesses. Owned by ISA-certified arborists and former university faculty, the Verdant Earth Educator team provides consultations on tree care and recommends climate-resilient opportunities for your valued green spaces. Verdant Earth Educators is all about seeding knowledge for success. Find Verdant Earth Educators at verdanteartheducators.com.
This podcast is being recorded on June 2nd, 2023. Rick Toller was born and raised in Rochester, New York. He tried going to college, but he didn't stick with it. After looking for a job, he was inspired by the Whole Earth catalog and began to explore carpentry. His exploration of carpentry trade led him to Corrales, New Mexico. It was in Corrales that he decided to resume his studies and attended the University of New Mexico. But after one semester, he dropped out again and started working in construction, building adobe houses, doing carpentry work, and making furniture. He was deeply inspired by George Nakashima and his free-form but highly disciplined designs. Rick was also inspired by the solar renaissance in New Mexico and in the idea of sustainable low-waste building and living. When Rick got married and his first child arrived, he needed a reliable income and started working in a commercial wood shop. Eventually, he became a project manager and estimator, and after 10 years was able to buy the shop and ran the business on his own. Rick eventually grew the business into a $10 million a year business. Rick sold the business in 2019 and bought a portable sawmill to use as a hobby. After all the carpentry work, he still thought of George Nakashima and his creations. Rick's son, Jacob, got interested in the sawmill and they started a business together. Jacob Toller was born and raised in Corrales, New Mexico. He worked at various jobs, but realized that he didn't want to work for someone else. So he opened his own business in Colorado. He had a successful business there from 2015 to 2020. After finding that he had a daughter on the way, he decided to sell the business and move back to New Mexico to be near family. Ariella was born right at the beginning of COVID with a heart defect that required surgery at 10 days old. Jacob got interested in his dad's hobby sawmill operation between hospital appointments, and they discovered that they liked working together. They decided to make a business out of the mill with a focus on turning dead, downed, and unwanted trees into planks for sale. This part of the business quickly led to a full-scale furniture operation, along with custom milling for other people in the business. He is looking forward to growing the business and keeping it sustainable for the future. Welcome to the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast, Rick and Jacob. We're delighted that you could be with us today.
Thanks for having us.
So, Rick, how did you and Jake get involved in reclaiming timber? And were you always interested in the art of wood or what is art?
Well, actually, I grew up in a family where nobody worked with their hands. And
I kind of rebelled against that. And I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I got interested in woodworking because I found out about it in the Whole Earth catalog, and also was inspired by a bunch of my friends. And I did a lot of reading and learned about guys like Sam Maloof and James Krenov. And I grew up in Rochester, New York. There's a guy named Wendell Castle, who was a really revolutionary woodworker there. And then I subscribed to Fine Woodworking magazine. And one of the early covers of Fine Woodworking magazine, an incredible picture of a guy named George Nakashima, a small Japanese-American guy who, the picture is of him standing in a room full of slabs. He's about 5'3", and the slabs are all 14 feet tall and 3 and 4 feet wide. And he developed a design aesthetic that was based on live edge slabs back in the 50s and 60s. And he was really one of my early primary inspirations. And so I kind of carried him around, and the work that he did, I carried it around in my head as I kind of got one job after another in the carpentry and building trades and developed some skills. And I always gravitated towards finished carpentry and cabinet work. And when I ended up in New Mexico, I kind of bounced from one thing to another, but I eventually got a job in a really good cabinet shop and worked there for 10 years and then ended up being able to buy it from the owners and run it myself for 20 years. And that part of the woodworking business was architectural woodworking, which is kind of highly specified and a lot of really highly precision stuff. I got into CNC technology, and I had a 28,000 square foot shop, and I had 100 employees, and we did work all over the Southwest and actually all over the country at one point. And then I decided to sell my business. But before I sold my business, I was just kind of getting, I didn't get to do any work in my shop for 30 years. When I'd come out to the shop and kind of approach a table saw, my employees would form a protective barrier around it, trying to keep me from hurting myself. But I, you know, I'm still a fairly good above average woodworker. And I thought maybe in my retirement, I would get back into it. So my daughter and my son-in-law had a house that we're actually sitting in the house right now. And outside on the street were two giant sycamore trees that had to be taken down. And I just remember looking at them one day and saying, you know, if those trees come down and they're solid inside, I'm going to buy a wood miser saw to slice them up and make planks out of them. And I was thinking about George Nakashima and about doing some of that work. And so we took the trees down. They were solid inside. I bought the saw. I had the money. And then when I finally sold my business, I kept it. And I actually put in my non-compete with the new owners that any products of my saw were exempt from non-compete. Yeah. I don't know why I did that, because I really wasn't thinking about going into business. But
you had to protect yourself.
Yes, got to protect yourself. And then my son-in-law and I, my son-in-law and my daughter were living in the house. And my son-in-law and I just started puttering around with the saw, and we cut up the sycamore tree and got some fabulous planks out of it. And then Jacob entered the story. So tell him how you entered the story.
So what happened was, I was living in Colorado. I had a small business up in Colorado, and me and my wife were expecting our first child. And so I wanted to be closer to home. Be close to my dad and my mom and my sister. They always say, you know, it takes an army to raise a kid. And so I decided to come back here. And my sister had just, we're actually in a 1950s adobe house right now. And this was my sister's former house. And she moved away right down the street from us. And luckily I moved in here, and she actually sold me the house. And so what I had told you in my bio is that we found out that my daughter had a heart condition. So me and my wife couldn't really work. And my dad had the saw on the property. And so we just kind of started messing around with the saw. And I kind of fell in love with it right away. I really enjoyed it. I loved the fact that every time you put a log on there, it's something different, something unique. And it feels like Christmas every time you cut into something. And I really enjoyed it. And what ended up happening is I posted some slabs on Facebook, and it took off. I had a lot of people contacting me, and I told my dad, I think we can maybe do this as a business. And so kind of forward a little bit. Now I have a 3,000 square foot shop. We still have a saw in the back. We have, I think we probably have over 100 slabs now. We have a kiln where we dry all of our stuff. And I really enjoy doing this. I really enjoy making things.
I think it's fabulous. That's a fabulous story. And I know Hal and I are like, we're tree huggers. Like,
yeah.
We're like the consummate tree huggers. And to know that that wood is being reutilized in a way that it's being honored.
Yeah.
That's a huge, I want to say, tribute to the tree's life and then its death, you know?
Yeah.
Or repurposing.
Or repurposing. Yeah, we don't want to say death because they really don't die.
Apparently, some other people have thought of this too because I looked it up online. I'm not the originator of the phrase, but I did come up with it by myself. We call it tree incarnation.
Yeah, I saw that in your bio.
There you go.
And it's true. I like that. We had a client on, a gentleman from California, John Mahoney, who said, from seed to senescence is the whole cycle, you know, and senescence isn't really, that goes even beyond that. It's almost like the spirit lives on kind of thing, you know, where the tree is reincarnated. So yeah, you're right about that. It's pretty amazing. And it's wonderful that people like yourselves appreciate that wood when you cut it open because it tells a story.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think that I would be doing it anyway, just to look at the, just to see what's there. Because I love trees, and I love them when they're standing. And we got lots of people that want us to take their trees down. And my son-in-law is a part-time arborist and does tree service work. And so we have the ability to do it. But I frequently just tell him, nah, we'll wait until it comes down by itself. Let it live its full lifespan. And so I just love trees just the way they are. And then I love them when they're lying on their sides and they've got some potential. And then we find the potential. And then what happened with our business is that we had only slabs and people would come in, and a lot of people just want to buy the slabs because they have their own businesses and they want to make stuff out of them. But almost, I would say, every other customer would come in and they'd say, well, I want you to make me something out of that. And you know, when I started doing this work, I made furniture in my driveway because I didn't have any place else to work. And all of a sudden, I found myself making furniture in the driveway again. And and there was so much of it that we just decided that we would really invest and put this building up. And so now we have the ability to not only sell slabs, make stuff out of the slabs, and then also we can do various stages of the process for other people. So it's a really good sort of three-pronged business.
Speaking of tree incarnation, guys, what happened to the sycamore? Did it find a new life?
We slabbed it up.
We slabbed it up and sold every slab.
Yeah.
Okay.
We should have kept one and made something out of it for ourselves.
What do you know about sycamore as far as working with it?
So my experience with sycamore, I've heard like mixed things. People say, right, you know, I love it, you know, I don't like it. And that's true for a lot of species that we sell. But for me personally, sycamore is actually one of my favorite woods, and it varies so much in color. I've never had a log that's the same. You know, we've had spalted sycamore. And it also, what I've noticed compared to other woods is it dries quite a bit quicker, which I think is a good thing. It's a little bit harder to keep flat. It's a little unstable. And it's real prone to like surface checking, but it's still one of my all time favorite woods. We actually made our countertop in our shop out of sycamore.
And your kitchen island.
Oh, and my kitchen island. Yeah. I forgot. So I'm a sycamore fan. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? Maybe you know the answer to this. Here in Philadelphia, it's called buttonwood.
Huh.
And I'm wondering if they used to make buttons from it. Because we used to have a lot of sewing. The sewing industry was like, we were the epicenter for sewing. And I always wondered if it was called buttonwood because they made buttons from it.
Maybe. It has this marvelous quarter sawn.
Yeah.
A lot of it in the tree. And we actually made our holes on our cabinets. Our shop partner, we have a guy that works with us in the shop, and he's a really good wood turner. And he made these incredible door and drawer pulls. And they're buttons with sycamore.
Quarter sawn sycamore.
And they're fabulous. And I guess maybe, yeah.
I would think so. because, yeah. You know, we had a lot of old sycamore when they first came to this country. And back in the 1700s, cabinetry was made here. We were the epicenter for cabinetry. And, you know, you hear these remnants of names of things and you think, well, they must have named it because they were using it for something, because that's how they would name things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, sycamore's a beautiful tree to begin with when it's living.
Yes.
But it's gorgeous when it's dead too, standing there as a snack. So it's exciting to hear that you're working with it and being able to plane it and lathe it and all that wonderful stuff.
Yeah, that's one of the other things that developed in our business is that there aren't that many big sycamores, and there actually aren't that many big trees at all in Albuquerque. But there's some really interesting different species around the state and around the area. And we got lucky a couple times and found walnut trees here, two here in Corrales, and then one in the southeast heights of Albuquerque. So a lot of the demand in this business is for trees that don't grow around here. So we've kind of reached out, you know, make connections over the internet and found people in other parts of the country that are willing to sell us logs. And, you know, one of my themes in this business is try to make it sustainable and to make it as close as net zero carbon as we can. And, you know, going and getting logs from far away is kind of not totally consonant with all that. But I realized kind of early on that the logs that we buy are low-grade logs. In my architectural woodworking business, if we had a knot or a piece of rot or a void in the log, we'd have to throw it away. It was wasted. In this business, those defects are features. And so we end up buying, I would say, probably 2 semi-truckloads a year. It's not a huge amount, but it's, you know, significant. But they're all logs that would have otherwise gone to maybe firewood. Or worse.
Or to the landfill, most of them go, right?
Yeah. So in that sense, we're at least partly making up for the carbon miles, the transport and the...
Sure. That sort of thing. Yeah, well, I think it's interesting because you're probably using spalted wood too. And
spalted, yes, absolutely.
And wood with big galls in it.
Burls,
yeah.
The timber industry doesn't want.
Right.
And so I think all across the country, there is people do the craziest things. We have a friend out in Algodones, New Mexico, who's a major furniture maker for the rich and famous. And he had a customer in Moore, Oklahoma, that was clearing a giant woodlot for a development and cutting down these 2 and 3 foot diameter pecan trees. And fortunately, the guy likes furniture. So we ended up with a bunch of these huge pecan logs from Oklahoma, which we slabbed and dried and gave them to our friend. But for every one of those guys that wants to make something out of the stuff that he clears away, there's probably 30 that just send them to the landfill and grind them up.
Yeah. And I made a new connection with a guy near the Phoenix area who has a big landscaping company. And I got in touch with him on Facebook, and he has this huge collection of logs that he's accumulated over time, because what they do is they go in and they clear all these huge lots for these apartment buildings, and he's just been saving all the wood. And I still have to make a trip up there to go see what he has, but they have all kinds of different connections. But I thought it was cool that he was actually, you know, saving these things, and he's not really selling. I mean, he wants a little bit of money for him, but not, you know, he's just trying to, you know, save the trees.
And what kind of wood is that, Jake?
So he has mesquite, acacia.
Acacia, yeah. There's some really, there's also a rosewood.
They call it Indian rosewood.
Indian rosewood that grows in Phoenix, and it grows pretty big. They're just kind of trees that are in the way. So they get cut down, and it's pretty spectacular wood. I participated in this Facebook page for Live Edge Slabs, and this guy came on, the same guy, I think he came on and said, I have Indian rosewood logs, and there's always one guy that comes on the thing and says, buy American, save the rainforest. And he said, well, he's growing Phoenix. Indian rosewood, but they're natives, so...
They're different species, you know.
That's the best thing. The other thing, too, is that it's so wonderful to know that there's this network of people that are feeding each other what they need, and and not having to have all that stuff go into the landfill. We need to be more conscious of that. And the more people like yourselves out there, the better, because it makes life that much cleaner and we get nicer furniture too.
It's all kinds of different people. It's an incredible spectrum of American humanity.
I like the idea too that I'm assuming some of this, like the fella in Phoenix, is probably some smaller diameter wood.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of that finding a home at the wood miser. You know, here in southeastern Pennsylvania with eastern hardwood, so often we're dealing with trees that are too big for the wood miser.
Yeah.
And so we're, to a certain extent, we're limited. Mm-hmm. But I did look at the great pictures on the website that you guys have put up, and I can see and really appreciate smaller diameter wood, like I'm assuming the Indian rosewood and things like that.
Yeah.
Which,
and now, you know, so we sell a lot of small stuff, you know, to the average person, you know, or, you know, a novice that's coming in, they don't want to buy, you know, a 9 foot slab that's 24 inches wide. They just don't have the
bandwidth.
And yeah, they don't have the space either, and it's heavy.
Literally.
It's heavy,
so
too.
I would say a lot of the stuff we sell is smaller. And it's, I like it, too, because it's also easier to cut. You know, it's easier to handle. So I really do enjoy cutting smaller stuff. And also now what's happening is we're getting a lot of requests for wood turning, the wood turners. And so when we do get stuff that's really small, you know, we can cut it up and they can turn it on.
Turning blanks.
Make turning blanks, turn on the lathe. And so that's been a great addition. The other day we cut a bunch of, I forget, it was like 100 turning blanks.
120, it was for a demonstration. I think it was, a total of 100, came out to about 150 turning blanks out of sweet gum, which is a kind of a...
That's a fun one.
Yeah.
And, you know, we made a lot of money doing it. And they got these fantastic turning blanks just in time for their big turning demo. There's another revenue stream, which is the charcuterie board industry. A lot of charcuterie.
That's true.
Of course. Yeah. And, how could we forget?
The small diameter stuff is really good for that.
Yeah.
I remember when I was in State College, when I was in Penn State, and there was a carpenter up there who took all the scrap wood, all the bits and pieces, and he pieced them all together. In fact, I think I have a piece. It's all little tiny pieces put together, and they were so, he couldn't keep them in stock.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
they were so different. And that was before the charcuterie boards were really, I mean, that's popular. Going back. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is I see them everywhere now. The charcuterie boards are solid pieces of wood. They're beautiful. They have the beautiful edges on them. Yeah. And they're great. And everybody wants them. Everybody wants them.
Yeah.
So.
We, my nephews live here in Corrales. And they have high-level college educations. But they chose to return to Corrales and become farmers. And one of my nephews has been a farmer since he was 16. Put himself through his MBA with growing stuff. And now together, the two of them have this incredible farming operation here. And they just opened a farm store and they teamed up with a coffee guy. And they have a coffee house and they sell their produce and they sell their plant starts and all this great stuff. And we made the countertops for the whole place and the tabletops with local stuff that grew right next to where they grew up. Big Russian olive tree. And so we just did that. I just wanted to, you know, contribute to their success. But as a result of having this out in the public, we've gotten probably $20,000 worth of work out of just in fact, the lady came by yesterday and she said, "Oh my God," she said, I was just, you know, rubbing my hand on the thing and I want something like this. And can you make me something like that? Yeah. So, I mean, people love the finished product. It is a form of love. They love it.
And people who love texture, they always have to feel things. You will see them with wood.
Yeah.
Because I know when we were talking about learning earlier before the podcast started about the different techniques of learning. And one of them is, you know, how do you first learn something? It's because you either put it in your mouth or you're feeling it as a kid, you know, you're crawling around. But as you get older, you carry that through and you find out that, you know, you touch everything or you look at the color of something and then you touch it. It's that kind of connection that wood can actually suffice for that type of learning.
Getting back to the specifics on species, and then I have a question about your kiln, but are you able to do anything with cottonwood?
I've done a cottonwood's just a little bit too soft of a wood. I've cut burls for people. Uh-huh. We've used those.
And they're spectacular. And cottonwood burls are spectacular.
They're super nice. But overall, we don't get a lot of requests for it, except when it comes to the burls. We've sold some of it, but it's not, I would say, if somebody had to choose between Chinese or Siberian elm and cottonwood, they would choose the elm because it's a harder wood.
I see. Well, interesting.
The two predominant big trees in this area are cottonwoods and Siberian elms. Siberian elms are invasive and they're kind of ugly and ugly for a tree. They get these weird bleeding sores on them.
We have them here too.
They drop a lot of
they
branches.
Just spread like
but
wildfire.
Boy, when you get a good one and you slab it up, they're fantastic.
Oh really?
Oh yeah. If you get a healthy one and it's not all rotted out, it's fantastic lumber. It doesn't smell very good. It's kind of like hanging around the elephant yard at the zoo, but
it really stinks.
all elm does
we
pretty
make
much.
Some just spectacular tables out of it. But if cottonwood were of equal quality, we'd probably be millionaires by now because there's major cottonwood.
Yes,
that is the wood and it's native, beautiful stuff.
It is, yeah.
Glorious, gnarled, 6, 8, 10 foot diameter trees that are 60 feet tall. But it's soft wood. It's kind of unstable. Giant branches come crashing down on people's houses all the time.
It's real fibrous.
Yeah. So it's not that great to
work.
Going back to the elm though, we're talking about the sycamore. Elm is also very unstable and it moves a lot when you try to dry it. Because I had this bright idea. I was like, well, what could I do with all the elm trees around here? And I was thinking about it and I was like, you know what? Maybe I could cut dimensional lumber out of, you know, these Chinese elm. And I learned real quick that they moved a whole lot and that wouldn't work out. So generally when I cut elm, I'm cutting it, 2.5 inches thick because I know it's going to move.
And then, Eva probably has mentioned, we've had several guests on that are, Urban Wood Network and wood reclamation and salvage and people doing amazing things. And we're so excited to just witness this movement, if you will. I don't think we've talked too much about the kiln and the drying. And my first thought is in New Mexico, you could probably get away without a kiln.
Yes.
Am I right?
Yes and no.
It's not in the winter time. So in the summer, it's extremely hot here. So it's almost too hot. You have to cover pretty much all your wood.
Interesting.
It'll
dries too fast.
Oh yeah, it'll dry too fast.
Yeah. Okay.
So we try to air dry stuff for as long as possible before putting it into our kiln.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the process and what technology you opted with as far as the kiln that you're using?
Yeah, so the kiln that we have right now, is it called a dehumidification kiln? And so it's basically, it was a shipping container, an old refrigeration unit that we had bought that was already insulated. And then we converted it with heaters and a dehumidifier in there and fans and That's basically where we dry our wood. We finish our wood in there. But what happens is we slab up a log on the saw, and then we stack it outside. We put it under cover, and we let it air dry as long as possible,
right.
Preferably down to under 20% moisture content before we put it in the kiln.
And we sticker the piles really carefully. Our stickers are all identical. Everything is flat, stays flat, and then we strap them with the cargo straps, get them really cranked down so that they dry flat.
Okay. And just for clarification, when you say sticker, you're not talking about an adhesive bag thing. You're talking about a piece.
Between every plank and log, we keep the logs, we try and keep them all together as a log. And then between every plank, there's an inch and a quarter piece of
There's a piece of timber.
Right. About every 16 inches, every 20 inches, so that the planks are separated and there's airflow between them, but they also stay flat.
But I've noticed too, you know, if wood wants to move, it's going to move.
That's right.
And so the straps help, but, you know, I've seen the straps get just totally pulled away by the wood. So it helps, but, you know.
Mm. You kind of keep going around and cranking them down, because as the wood shrinks, the straps become loose. So you have to.
What are the stickers made out of? What kind of wood are they made from?
We use poplar.
Poplar, okay.
Also known as cottonwood.
No, is it species poplar or is it Liriodendron tulipifera? Because they call that poplar too.
It's sold to us as poplar. That's the one thing we buy, that kiln dried from a local supplier, and it is actual poplar. It's probably shown in Oregon.
Yeah, because ours is called yellow poplar, and it's not poplar at all. Liriodendron tulipifera, which is a tulip tree.
Which I never knew until Eva schooled me in the early days of the podcast.
Oh, goodness gracious. I went in and picked my slabs out, and I have a yellow poplar desk. I just love it. And I wanted to make sure that there was nice heart. I'm like, I'm really into wood. My house has lots of wood furniture. I mean, it's really...
No, this is real poplar. It's that... We used it in my architectural woodworking business a lot for blocking and kind of hidden stuff, because it's not pretty. It's kind of gray, bland.
It's like a dusty kind of gray, yeah.
But it's real stable, and it's not acidic, so it doesn't stain the wood quite so much.
So can you ballpark what your investment is on the kiln? The reason I keep asking these questions, I think there's a lot of people, including our listeners, that, you know, play with the idea of getting a wood miser and getting into it. But I think they feel like the kiln is kind of a stumbling block.
Well, it is. We started out with, we found a used Nile Systems kiln setup, and the ones that you buy off the shelf are very expensive. And it was just inadequate. It didn't even work for our original kiln space. So we started kind of looking around, and the investment that you would have to make for the kiln unit itself to adequately dry the kind of loads that, you know, our kiln is 24 by 8 by 8. So that's, you know, it's pretty good cubic footage. To buy a commercial kiln setup would have been, just for the units alone, would be about $10,000. And then you got to figure out how to build space. So unfortunately, we decided to do this right at the height of the pandemic, when the demand for containers was spectacular and the prices went way up. But I can tell you, we spent $8,400 on the container ready to go, with doors on both ends so that it can be through feed. And then we spent another $2,500 on a bunch of used conveyor. So the whole floor of the kiln is conveyor. And then we have conveyor outside on both ends, so we can kind of move stuff through the kiln in either direction. It gives us a lot of flexibility. And then what we had been spending on electricity for our Nile Systems unit to heat a much smaller space was probably average over the year or two that we had it. We were spending $250 to $350 a month.
That's expensive.
On electricity. Yeah. And that wasn't going to work because it was a bigger space. So we decided to just go with a radiant gas heater, which now we find is averaging, over the course of the year, it averages under $50 a month to heat the kiln.
Well, that's a big difference. That's a huge difference.
And in the summer, it's like
in the summer, it's the cost of heat is negligible. And in the winter, it's $7,500 a month, maybe at the most. To keep the kiln, we start the load at about 85, then we ramp up to 110 over the course of a few months, but it's 24/7. So for the gas heater and a commercial dehumidifier,
and a bank of commercial heavy-duty fans to create air circulation inside the kiln. We had another about $6,000. If we'd have done it ourselves, probably could have done it for three, but our plumber was really interested in it, and he was on site, and we don't really have all the skills that we need to do it right, so we paid to have that done. So we have about $20,000 total sunk in our kiln, and we can dry 3,000 board feet of lumber in a load, and that what that ends up is adding about $2 a board foot in value to the plank. So it's economically pretty sound. The big problem that we've been learning by trial and error how it works. We lost a lot of time and effort because we've got case hardening, which is a problem that when you try and dry it too fast and other just all this other trial and error kind of stuff.
Learning.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to ask you, when you put the fans and the dehumidifier in, that actually helps to level out everything within the context of the dehydration process.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that way you don't have as much warping. And then, you know, so that makes a lot of sense. Because if you have pockets of moisture and then pockets dry, your wood's not going to be top quality.
It has to be. And so that's kind of what I was getting to, is frustrating I'm in a hurry all the time. I'm just having to teach myself. Jacob is having to teach me how to wait.
And you have to be really patient.
Yeah.
I was gonna ask you, what are you teaching your dad, Jacob?
Patient. I think what happened, you know, with the whole, you know, cabinet business, it's like go, 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 you know, and with this, especially even, you know, furniture making and stuff like that, you have to be very patient, you know, especially with the, you know, kiln drying, it's a long process. And, you know, if you're patient, it generally comes out best at the end.
That's well said.
I have to laugh because I think of my own children and I learn from them all the time.
Yeah.
Things I wish I would have known when I was younger.
Yeah. Well, me too. You know,
that's where the genius is. That's where the genius is when you have a good business partner like your son.
Yeah. In my other business, in most American business, the whole thing is speed to market, you know, get it there. And in this business, you just got to take the long view and be just relaxed and make it happen.
It kind of reminds me of making a fine garment. When you're making a tailored suit, you want to make sure that everything is perfect and you know those buttons are put on and the buttonholes are done properly. And it's going to take a lot of time, and you're going to pay for that time. And if you're going to be doing the right thing and you're making a good piece of furniture or you're making a good spindle for a balustrade, you're doing gold work. I mean, you're going to pay for it, but in the end, it's going to be far less expensive than if you do cheap work.
Yeah. Yeah, and we are teaching our customers that too. And they say, well, why would it be that expensive?
Well, it takes, you know.
That's the reason is.
I would say the average person, well, not the average, I would say people just don't understand how long it takes to actually dry like a hardwood, you know, and how patient you have to be, you know. Sometimes, you know, we have stuff that's, you know, been sitting for over a year, you know, that probably won't get dry until a year and a half.
Oh my
goodness. Until it turns into a finished project.
Even with a kiln,
still takes time.
If you were air drying it, it could take 3, 4, 5 years before it's really dry. And
well,
you really drop.
How long did that tree take to grow? So
that was the next thing I was going to say. You know, in my other business, people would come and say, we need this to be 20 feet long and 2 feet wide and no knots. And I said, well, you know, you really should have ordered the tree in 1924. It's so hard to come by that kind of stuff.
That's great. Wow. Well, I have to say, this has been a very pleasant, and the vibes from, is it Corrales?
New Mexico.
Yes. Corrales, are very good for Eva and myself, or I'm speaking for myself. I'm assuming
Oh, yes, you're right. Yes. You're right.
Yeah, I'm way more relaxed now than at the start of the conversation. Yeah. So I have to ask you, Rick, when you first arrived in New Mexico, since you and I are the same age, were you driving a VW van or a VW bug?
I didn't get my first VW until I'd been here for a couple of years. I was actually driving my dad's Dodge Dart. I had intended to buy a international snowplow pickup truck to make this journey in, and my dad went to look at it with me, and he said, "No, son, take my car." So I drove a 1968 Dodge Dart for a long time.
Great.
And then...
Great. Very steady.
That's funny. We had a VW, too, as our first vehicle.
Yeah. But then I got a bug, and then I actually... My first real work truck was a VW pickup truck
with
the 9-foot bed and the fold-down sides. They should still make those. They're incredible.
Same thought.
Incredible. Yeah.
Do you guys have a favorite tree?
I think mine would be sycamore.
Okay.
Yeah, because we can get it around here. It grows all over and always super unique.
Nice.
And I like Russian olives.
Oh, yeah. And here in our area, they're classified as invasive.
Yes.
Same here.
Well, but you know, we are the invasive species.
Well, I knew that. So could you tell somebody else that?
I don't hold it against the Russian olive.
love it.
Yeah, we are the invasive species. And I'll just circle back. Elms don't smell bad. Humans have decided that they smell bad.
Right, yeah.
Elms have no problems with how humans smell.
Did you know that during the Revolutionary War, the treaty elm was guarded by the British, of all people, not to take down the Treaty Elm. They were told that they had to keep watch over the Treaty Elm because it was so important to the colonies. The British watched over it. And the people didn't want to use elm to heat their fireplaces because it stunk so bad.
Yeah.
So a lot of elms were left, but when they were really desperate, they went after every piece of elm they could find. So I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Information.
When I was growing up, my street was a canopy of Dutch elms. They met over the street. They were gigantic. And by the time I went to high school, they were all gone.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, the American elm.
When I was in horticulture school, the books that were illustrating loss of canopy due to American elm and Dutch elm disease, and Rochester was always that black and white photo of here's 1966 and here's 1967 before and after photos. Well, guys, you've been great. We really enjoyed our time with you.
It was wonderful.
I learned a lot. I hope our listeners did too. The website has some great Russian olive lumber photos, so feast your eyes.
And keep up the great work. We really are in awe of your work.
Thanks. And thanks for having us.
Yeah. And we'll talk more.
Okay. Take
care. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you, guys.
The Plant a Trillion Trees podcast is edited by Andromedan Recordings in Hollywood, California. Thank you.